A decision in front of the U.S. Supreme Court could affect 700,000 young people in this country. That's according to the New York Times, and that opinion could come down any time. 9 justices are set to rule whether the Trump administration can end the DACA program. The program keeps U.S. officials from deporting immigrants brought to the U.S. as kids. We're talking about it this hour of the morning show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent, and you're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Supreme Court's forthcoming ruling? How do you think the court or the Trump administration or Congress should address the 700,000 participants of the program? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Our guest is Luca Weiss-Ottesen, who's an immigration attorney and partner at the DeWitt Law Firm. She works with clients on family-based and individual immigration applications, as well as employment visas. Luca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you, Keely, for having me on your show.
Thanks for being here. The case up for debate right now is the Department of Homeland Security versus the University of California. What's the high court deliberating here?
The first thing that they're having to decide is whether the court actually has the authority to review this decision to begin with. The government's contention from the beginning was that it has full discretion to rescind the DACA program, and that decision is not reviewable by courts. Now, if the court does decide that it has the authority to review this decision, then they will move on to the second question in the case, and that is, did the Trump administration properly execute their authority to rescind the program? The interesting thing about this case is neither party is arguing that the administration lacks the authority to terminate the program. The argument is more, did the administration follow the proper process to announce its termination of the program, and did they do it in compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act?
So let's go through a couple of scenarios, though. Then if the high court rules that they have jurisdiction, they can follow on to that second question. But if they say, no, we actually don't get to decide this, what happens?
That's a really good question. It would effectively give a major win to the Trump administration, and they would be able to start implementing the decision to rescind DACA. And that could be right away, and it could be a rollout plan. They have not yet announced either of those.
Sure. So in that circumstance, the court would be saying, we can't intervene here, so it's up to you, the administration, do what you need to do.
Exactly.
Now, if the court is able to move on to those other questions, how are we supposed to understand what that might look like? I mean, is the constitutionality of the DACA program really in question here?
It could potentially be. So it's DACA is a fascinating concept because it's not actually based on statute. It's a deferred action. It is a program that many administrations have used in some version or another, but it's not based on a particular area of law that says the administration can enforce or can implement a deferred action. Instead, deferred action comes from a part of the statutes that allow executive branches to prioritize their budgets and their policies and to issue policies that prioritize that their authority to enforce the law. You know, the budget only allows for so many people to be removed from the United States per year because, you know, it costs money. So then what DACA did was prioritize these enforcement costs and putting individuals with very low risk at the bottom of the priority list.
We are talking with Luca Weiss-Ottesen, who's a Madison-based immigration attorney, and she's helping us understand the Supreme Court's upcoming decision on DACA. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you want to better understand about what the Supreme Court is deciding? How do you think our elected officials should handle this situation, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules? And what federal immigration policy would you like to see? 800-642-1234. Luca, take us back to 2017. What did the Trump administration set out to do to change with DACA, as you've described it?
Right. So in September 2017, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary issued a memorandum basically stating that they were rescinding the DACA program. And initially, the plan was they were going to stop accepting applications for individuals who had never had DACA before, so first-time applicants. And they would also phase out renewal applications. The announcement indicated that they would continue to accept renewal applications for another month. So since September, first-time applicants have not been able to apply for DACA. Renewals, though, did continue beyond that 1 month that the announcement initially indicated, and that is because litigation started almost immediately after the announcement came out, and through court injunctions, the administration was ordered to continue allowing existing DACA recipients to apply for renewal.
And although there are many layers and different timelines for different people who have applications or are part of this, it's created a lot of uncertainty. Is that fair to say?
Correct.
When you talk to people who are part of this program that you're working with, what do they bring to the table on that front?
On the uncertainty front, more uncertainty. They're trying to stay positive, but they're also planning for contingencies. But there really is not a whole lot to plan for. I mean, the program was implemented for individuals who came to the United States, who were brought to the United States when they were, some of them, itty-bitty babies. They had no decision in this. They've never known any country of their own. This country is the only home that they've known. So for them to plan to move someplace else after they've lived here for, you know, 2 decades, some of them 3 decades, some of them almost 4 decades, and have families here and careers and professions and a home, and some of them are business owners, it's not something that it's easy to wrap your head around.
So with this going through the courts, with the Trump administration's changes to the expectations under President Obama, we've put a lot of people in a holding pattern?
Pretty much. And the DACA program was pretty much a watered-down version of what the DREAM Act would have been. And some of the listeners and you may probably be familiar a little bit with the DREAM Act, but that was a piece of legislation that was introduced in Congress several times in recent decades, and it never passed. It never materialized into law. So because it never materialized into law, it was, you know, eventually implemented through this DACA program, and the approvals of DACA basically come in 2-year increments, but they don't really lead anywhere beyond that. DACA is not a path to permanent residence. It's not a path to citizenship. It's not a path to virtually anything. So in a way, DACA holders have been in a holding pattern since the DACA program was instituted. It's just that it put them in a more secure position. It gave them more footing. It gave them the ability to come out from living in the shadows. It can't give them the ability to pursue higher education, work legally, and, you know, be upstanding citizens for all intents and purposes, except that they're not actually U.S. citizens.
Immigration attorney Luca Weiss-Ottesen stays with us for this hour. She's a labor and employment relations expert. And we're talking about a decision on DACA that is set to come from the U.S. Supreme Court really any time now. Your thoughts, your questions about it are welcome at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Keely Boltina. This conversation continues this hour on The Morning Show. We are waiting on word from the country's highest court to find out what happens to hundreds of thousands of people. U.S. officials told DACA recipients they were safe from deportation after they came to the U.S. without papers when they were children. The Trump administration wants to end the program, and we're talking about what that means in Wisconsin and beyond. Thanks for joining us. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and your calls are welcome here on the Ideas Network, 800-642-1234. What is your question about the Supreme Court's forthcoming ruling on DACA? How do you want to see elected officials handle immigration here in the United States? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Luca Weiss-Ottesen is an immigration attorney and labor and employment relations expert, and we're talking about it here for the hour. And Luca, the immigration rights organization Voces de la Frontera estimates there are 6,600 DACA recipients here in Wisconsin. What are the implications of this ruling for people who are currently enrolled?
Yes, based on the Homeland Security information and records that are publicly available, it does appear that there are about 6,600 individuals in the state of Wisconsin that received DACA pursuant to this program. And if this program ends, these 6,600 individuals, along with the remaining almost 700,000 nationwide, will eventually lose their work authorization and the protection from deportation, which is basically the two main benefits that the DACA program offers. Now, the administration, when they announced that they would terminate the program, they did indicate that they wouldn't revoke existing approvals, and instead they would allow those approvals to run their course and expire on their own terms. And because DACA is issued in two-year increments, depending on when these 6,600 Wisconsinites got their most recent approval, they will start their expiration dates will start slowly phasing in, and it can be anywhere from next week, next month, next year, or if they just got approved 2 weeks ago, then they still have almost two years clean on their work authorization and deferred action.
That's an incredible difference in timeline for people. I mean, thinking that I might have 2 years to figure out what comes next, almost 2 years versus 2 weeks, that's a really intimidating concept.
It is. When this lawsuit was initiated, the data that the parties had at the time were estimating nationwide that about 1,400 DACA recipients would lose status each day.
We're talking with immigration attorney Luca Weiss-Ottesen as we break down the case before the Supreme Court about DACA and the potential implications for program recipients, sometimes known as Dreamers. Your calls are welcome at 800-642-1234. And we've got Jim from Vilas County ready to join the conversation. Welcome to the Ideas Network, Jim.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my question. My question, it might involve DACA, it might not, I'm not sure, but my question is, I have a friend from India who's been here 15 years with his family, and he's been working on a work visa. He's been employed, has a very good job. They love it here. He's been working on being a citizen for close to 15 years, and it's still paperwork, and it's still going through it. And my question is, why is it so difficult for good people with a proven record of being employed? Why is it so difficult for them to be citizens? Why is there so much paperwork? If it seems both parties say they want good people to be citizens here, why? Can you just explain to me why it would take 15 years for someone to be a citizen? His son is going to UW-Madison, and he's very concerned that if this paperwork doesn't go through pretty soon, that his son will have to go back to India. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Jim, thanks for the question. A pretty big question, Luca.
Yes, Jim, thank you. That is a great question, and that is one that, unfortunately, I have to answer pretty often to my clients as well. The Indian nationals are perhaps one of the most impacted population when it comes down to permanent residence and U.S. citizenship, permanent residence more than U.S. citizenship, and that is because the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is basically the Bible of immigration law that we have on the books right now, has established quotas. And the quotas are based on the country that immigrants are from. There are roughly about 140,000 employment-based permanent residence visas that could be issued per year. And they are prioritized depending on the type of case that each individual has. Now, your friend was from India, and I'm assuming that his permanent residence case is going through his job, is unfortunately subject to a backlog that is on average about 10 to 12 years. And that is particular to Indian nationals and particular to employment-based cases, and it is caused by these quotas. And it doesn't really matter that your friend is an outstanding individual and a perfect worker. Unfortunately, the quotas are set in such a restrictive way that he basically has to wait his turn in line.
Thanks for that question. And Luca, thank you for your answer there. When you're talking about those quotas when it comes to citizenship and the DACA program, which you said is not a path to citizenship, is there a relationship there at all? Or are these completely separate portions of our U.S. immigration law?
They are completely separate. And the quotas are not towards citizenship. The quotas are towards permanent residence. So normally, to become a U.S. citizen, you have to have been a permanent resident, a green card holder, for a certain number of years. So for DACA, for instance, for them to move from DACA to permanent residence, first of all, there's no direct path there. They would have to find another eligibility ground that would put them in line to become permanent residents. And then because they're DACAs and because they are here undocumented, the problem with DACAs is that even though they may, say for instance, DACA marries a U.S. citizen, right? That wouldn't still put them on a path to permanent residence necessarily. That would make them eligible as an immediate relative. But if they're here undocumented, they are still likely inadmissible, which is another thing that a client or an applicant has to show to become permanent resident. So in the Indian Nationals example, he would be eligible because he has a profession and a job that is willing to sponsor him. He is likely admissible, assuming there are no skeletons in his closet that would render him inadmissible. But in his case, there is no immigrant visa immediately available because of the quota. In the DACA cases, they may be eligible if they have a family or employment relation to qualify them. They may have an immigrant visa immediately available. For instance, spouses of U.S. citizens are not subject to a quota, but they are inadmissible because of their undocumented status.
So much of what you're explaining to us is individual specific. And when it comes to DACA, dealing with 700,000 individuals, is that how you have to view cases for these DACA applicants or people who are part of the program on a case-by-case-by-case situation?
Absolutely. There really is no one-size-fits-all in immigration. It's pretty rare that you see a handful of cases that are identical.
How do you even begin to get your arms around that then when it deals with such a swath of people?
One case at a time.
Yeah. A poll this spring by Harvard, Stanford, and the University of Texas researchers says about 61% of Americans support keeping the DACA program intact. What's Congress's role in this policy?
Congress, like I mentioned earlier, they did have the opportunity to pass the DREAM Act several times, and they did not do so. The biggest holdup in these negotiations and in these legislations usually comes down to whether to afford DREAMers, DREAMers is what we usually refer to as the DACA recipients. So the biggest holdup and the most contentious item in these negotiations is whether to put them on a path to U.S. citizenship or even permanent residence or not. The more progressive side of the aisle, of course, wants to put them on a path to U.S. citizenship. The more conservative usually is trying to lean away from citizenship. All of these discussions, though, have included multiple hurdles that DREAMers or applicants would have to pass, even if they did have a path to citizenship. So they're talking anywhere from making sure that their income taxes are up to date, making sure that they don't have any significant criminal record, meeting some sort of physical presence and residence requirements, and so on. So it's not a blank check. Okay, we passed the law, now you're a U.S. citizen. It would put them on a path. It would give them a plan and certain criteria that they have to meet over a period of years before they can become first a permanent resident, and then after they spend X number of years as a permanent resident, then they could potentially become eligible for citizenship. So again, it's not, no proposal has advanced an overnight solution. It always included a multiple year plan.
Hasn't gone through. We're talking with Luca Vias-Odison, who's an immigration attorney, and we're discussing the forthcoming ruling by the Supreme Court on DACA. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Stay with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is The Ideas Network. A program to protect young undocumented immigrants started under President Barack Obama. It lets people who came to the U.S. as kids stay in America, and it allows them to work. President Donald Trump wants to end deferred action for childhood arrivals, and now 9 Supreme Court justices are set to decide whether that can happen, and they could make their decision public anytime. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you a DACA recipient? How will this ruling affect your situation? Maybe someone in your family is enrolled in DACA. What is your experience like dealing with the immigration and the court system? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. Luca Vias-Odison is an immigration attorney and has experience in legal aspects of U.S. citizenship and naturalization, and we're talking about it here. Luca, Steve from Wanakee wants to know, who is bringing this lawsuit that's in front of the Supreme Court, and why?
So when the administration announced that the program would be terminated, several states and universities instituted this lawsuit trying to block the administration from pursuing it. As to why, by terminating DACA, this would negatively impact employers who are hiring DACA recipients. It would negatively impact universities who would potentially be losing actively enrolled students that are pursuing higher education by virtue of having DACA. So it is, in a way, the plaintiffs were trying to protect their interest in engaging with DACA recipients.
The deferred action part of the DACA acronym, it's referring to really to deportation. I mean, what can change on this front based on the different ways the court could rule?
That is a very good question. When the program was implemented back in 2012, a lot of people and a lot of families were reluctant to apply because they did not trust the government's assurance that the government would not use any biographic information or identifiable information about these families to pursue deportation later on. So it took a lot of work to get people to trust the program. Now, with the possibility of the program going away, of course, the biggest concern is the government going to use the information that they have collected for the last 8 years to now pursue these families and initiate removal proceedings since deportation is no longer deferred. I wish I had an answer to this question, but I don't. The government has been inconsistent about their statements and their actions. They do continue to state that they will not use the information, yet there have been reported actions of detaining DACA holders. So it's really hard to tell you exactly what terminating the deferred action on deportation and what effect that would actually have immediately.
Beyond the legality of the program ending, when I hear you talk about trying to convince people to participate so that they would have a way to work and get education here through this official program, I just wonder, I mean, should we have walked into DACA assuming that it might end, or did we message this to recipients in a way that, that implied that this was a long-term safe option?
I don't honestly know that it was messaged in either direction. Like I mentioned before, this was a decision, implementing this program was a decision made in response to Congress being unable to pass any legislation. So, and because the program was implemented in two-year increments, there was always this chance lurking in the background that the program would eventually end or could eventually end. It was something that was implemented by virtue of the executive branch's authority, and as the executive branch and the administration changes every 4 years, every 8 years, or, you know, how many terms a president remains in office, it is always a chance that the next administration will not like it. And that goes for any policy that is implemented by the administration, and as opposed to a law that is implemented by Congress.
Attorney Luca Weiss-Ottesen represents DACA recipients and is here as we discuss the fate of this federal program. The U.S. Supreme Court is deciding what will happen with DACA and whether the Trump administration can end the program. And we're taking your calls, your questions about it at 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about the Supreme Court's forthcoming ruling? Maybe you are curious about Congress's role or the Trump administration's role or even what the Supreme Court can really do. Share your question with us. Ask it of an immigration attorney now at 800-642-1234. Also, how should we handle the people who are enrolled in DACA right now? How do you want to see officials treat them? 800-642-1234. Luca, what effect does this back and forth, this court order and these deliberations over DACA, what has that had on the relationship between the government and immigrant communities?
Well, it hasn't made it easier, that's for sure. The government is clearly attempting to terminate the program, which has eroded a little bit the trust that the prior administration had built with the immigrant communities. And terminating DACA has not been the only immigration program that this administration has tried to eliminate. So it's built quite a bit of tension between the immigrant communities and the federal government. And even at the local level, some jurisdictions are have been pretty much deputized by the federal government under a particular section of the law to enforce some immigration laws. So it's uneven throughout the country. It, for a lot of immigrant communities, it is more uncertain than for others, depending on where they live.
What are consequences if people who are undocumented can't trust our government system? Does it create fear?
It does create fear, and there are several advocates that have advanced the notion that it pretty much infringes on the immigrant population's ability to seek out law enforcement when they need to. One of the effects that we have seen in recent years was immigration raids at the courthouses, for instance, where you have individuals going to the courthouse to, you know, do anything from paying a traffic ticket to being a witness in a completely non-immigration related matter. ICE has performed detentions and arrests at the courthouse. So it gets to the point to which some immigrant communities are concerned about going forward and coming forward to use the protections that your local law enforcement could provide for fear that ICE would be waiting around the corner.
If the DACA program is allowed, is legally allowed to end, do recipients have any legal ability to continue their lives here if they don't have DACA status?
It's going to depend from case to case. Some DACA recipients may potentially have some alternatives, but they are not straightforward cases. Otherwise, they would have gone down that route to begin with. The biggest challenge for DACA recipients is perhaps how it's going to depend on how they came to the United States in the first place. The biggest element that will distinguish these cases is whether they came in with a visa or undocumented altogether. The law that we have on the books now, and that has been on the books for decades, basically states that an individual who came here without inspection and was not formally admitted, as a general rule, cannot adjust status to permanent residence inside of the United States. They could start the process here, but they would have to, at some point in the procedure, leave the United States and complete the process through the U.S. consulate. Well, the same Immigration and Nationality Act indicates that if an individual spent more than 1 year in the United States in undocumented status, the minute they leave the United States and go abroad, even if it's to go to the consulate to try to fix their status, they automatically trigger a 10-year bar from being readmitted.
The consulate in America, because it is technically not U.S. soil anymore.
Yeah, it's the U.S. consulates abroad. All of the consulates are in foreign countries. So they would basically have to leave the United States, go to Mexico or Guatemala or Europe or whatever their home country where they were born is, and then apply for an immigrant visa at the U.S. consulate present in their home country. So, and you're correct, because they're no longer on U.S. soil, they're outside of the United States, and if they spent more than 1 year undocumented in the United States, by leaving the U.S., they would trigger this 10-year bar. Now, the advantage of DACA is that time spent in DACA doesn't actually count for this, have you spent more than 1 year undocumented in the United States. Also, the time in undocumented status only starts, the clock starts running once they turned 18. So depending on how young they were when they got here, how young they were when they got their first DACA, how many times they renewed it, if there was any lag between the validity periods, all of that has to be calculated to determine whether they have in the aggregate more than 1 year in undocumented status. And depending on, you know, what that equation comes down to or comes up to, you can make an informed decision whether it would be safe to leave the country and try to adjust to try to fix the status of
yes.
the country.
And this is The Morning Show. We'll continue this conversation just ahead. We're talking about immigration law here on The Morning Show. We're awaiting a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court about DACA. That's the program that protects Dreamers. They came to the U.S. as children and now go to school and work in this country. I'm Keely Boltina. Luca Weiss-Ottesen is a Wisconsin immigration attorney. She's our guest, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Carl from Hayward who has a question about our immigration system. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. I'm wondering about Social Security. If an undocumented immigrant comes here and I hire them or somebody hires them, I don't hire them, but and I have to pay Social Security on them, and that Social, can they use that Social Security if they're undocumented? And what happens to that money then that is into the government that they pay in but they can't use?
All right, Carl. Thanks for the question. Luca, how do we figure out the relationship between immigration and Social Security payments?
That is a very good question. And Carl, you're right. They are paying into Social Security, and that is money they cannot use. To begin with, most undocumented individuals don't have a valid Social Security number. Up until a couple of decades ago, they used to be able to get Social Security numbers valid in their name, but the law changed And for the last couple of decades, the Social Security Administration has not issued valid socials to undocumented individuals. Now, DACA holders, for instance, they have one, even though they're technically still undocumented, because they have work authorization, they are eligible for a Social Security number. So a lot of the individuals that Carl is talking about that are completely undocumented and don't have a social, they could be working with made-up Social Security numbers. So those contributions don't actually go to anybody's account because that account doesn't actually exist. Or they could be working with tax identification numbers, which are some numbers that the IRS issues to individuals that are not eligible for a Social Security number. So they issue tax identification numbers so that they can use that to file taxes and pay taxes. But otherwise, they are not eligible to collect on these Social Security contributions that they are contributing to, at least not until or unless they do become permanent residents at some point.
Which, as we have talked about, is an extensive and very up-in-the-air question. Carl, thank you so much for that call and for your curiosity here. We're talking with Luca Weiss-Ottesen, who's a Madison-based immigration attorney. She works with clients on family-based and individual immigration applications, as well as employment visas. The justice system is not unique in that its operations have been affected by this pandemic. Luca, how have immigration courts been functioning since March?
Good question. So immigration court for Wisconsin, for instance, for individuals that are in Wisconsin, immigration court is in Chicago. Now, immigration court only adjudicates removal cases. They don't actually adjudicate DACA applications or applications for other immigration benefits. Those go to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the Citizenship and Immigration Services Office in Milwaukee for Wisconsin people. And they have, you know, they're different agencies. They have different rules. Homeland Security, the Citizenship and Immigration Services, they stopped in-person interviews in the middle of March. That basically put most of the cases that they had before them on hold. And they just resumed in-person appointments on June 4th, so just a couple of weeks ago, and they're just now prioritizing their workload and trying to reschedule things that got canceled. Immigration courts, for the removal aspect of it, and then that's the court in Chicago, they, at the beginning of the pandemic, they tried to operate under just normal operating procedures. They continued to hold in-person hearings, and they didn't deschedule anything. They weren't encouraging continuances or rescheduling either. The problem with that, though, was the courtrooms were pretty packed. The waiting rooms were pretty packed. Once everybody became clear that social distancing was something that everybody was going for, especially after we got, you know, state orders encouraging or ordering social distancing, immigration courts were not actually able to provide an environment where attorneys and immigrants appearing for those hearings could safely be there and engage in social distancing. Yet, for a while, immigration courts continued to operate. And it wasn't until a few weeks into the pandemic or a few weeks into the, basically April, that the Department of Justice, which oversees immigration courts, finally determined to cancel all hearings for that month. And then they basically reevaluated every so many weeks. They had no hearings for the month of May either, and then in June they started reopening some courts throughout the country at some level. They did continue to run hearings for many of the immigrants that were detained, and those hearings were mainly done telephonically or through video conferencing, but for individuals who were not detained, after a while and after a lot of back and forth and a lawsuit being filed, immigration courts did eventually cancel all of the hearings.
What immigration court services have been able to resume recently?
They're still not holding, at least right now, they're still not holding in-person hearings for non-detained cases, I believe until the end of the month, but that's just for Chicago. Although this could change, and they do update their page quite frequently, multiple times a day sometimes. And they are still holding hearings for detained individuals, though.
What about when it comes to citizenship? Are all of those opportunities stalled right now?
They are. They have been stalled since the middle of March, with USCIS now having reopened their offices for in-person meetings. And on June 4th, they have so far prioritized citizenship and naturalization oath ceremonies that would have been scheduled over this three-month period, and that there were that had to be unscheduled or canceled. Now, normally, the naturalization oath ceremonies would take place at federal courthouses, and they could, you know, have anywhere from like 50 to 70 people taking the oath at the same time. That is no longer an option under the social distancing rules. So instead of having these massive oath ceremonies at courthouses, they're now trying to do administrative oath ceremonies within the USCIS offices, within Homeland Security, and they're maybe trying to have 3-4 people in the room at a time and then trying to get as many through the day as possible. Clearly, they have a considerable backlog to go through right now since they were closed and had no ceremonies for 3 months. So it will take a while to catch up, especially since this government agency is potentially going to see a big number of furloughs in the coming months.
And how has your work been affected now?
That is a really good question, and that is something that I'm still trying to figure out. It is all over the map. It went from putting out fires from one day to the next to trying to go back to the cases that would not necessarily have had a deadline on them. When this started, the first border closure was affecting only individuals from China. At the end of January. But then as more countries started being added to the list, culminating with virtually most of Europe in March, I had clients stuck all over the world. I had clients here, corporate clients, employers, whose employees were stuck in India or Europe or somewhere else in the world, and they were affected by the travel restrictions that were being implemented because of COVID. So everybody was scrambling. We were scrambling to get our people back here. We were scrambling to make sure that we were meeting deadlines. And everybody did great under the circumstances, but it has been a really hectic last 3 months in an already hectic and very dynamic area of law.
Luca, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Keely.
Luca Weiss-Ottesen is an immigration attorney and a partner at the DeWitt Law Firm. And we've spent this hour talking about the Supreme Court case on DACA that is set to come out anytime now, and also about how the pandemic has affected immigration work, and also took your questions about our U.S. immigration system. Just ahead on Point, we've got a New York Times business writer about how racial hostility has been baked into American politics and why it keeps derailing our conversations on our economy. I'm Keely Boltina. Your host, Kate Archer Kent, returns tomorrow here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.